This is the IBJ podcast for the week of January 25th, 2021. I'm Mason King. Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. There's been a lot of talk over the last several years about politics opening rifts between family members, but I am confident that there still isn't anything as potentially poisonous to family relations as money. And while at least some of us like to think that we can discuss anything with our families, no dinner table conversation, at least for families of some means, is more awkward than parents discussing their estate plans with their children. Now, of course, these conversations touch on the two terrible constants of the universe, death and taxes, but I think a lot of the tension arises from the different and sometimes conflicting expectations we have about how money and other assets should pass from one generation to the next. Now, over his former career as a professional financial advisor and then as personal finance guru, Pete the Planner, Pete Dunne has seen a lot of wealth transfers go off the rails. And he's talked with a lot of folks who failed to do adequate retirement planning because they assumed they were getting a substantial inheritance. In his column for IBJ this week, he tackles a very ticklish question from two readers about whether they should share substantial details about their net worth, estate plans, and wishes for charitable giving with their adult children. We're going to talk about Pete's advice in more detail in this week's edition of the podcast, but we'll also expand the conversation to other tricky issues that parents and their adult children should consider when either planning an estate or contemplating an inheritance. Strap in, here's our conversation. As always, I am very happy to welcome to the IBJ virtual podcast studio, Pete Dunne, Pete the Planner. Pete, happy 2021.
New year, still here in this same chair I've been in for 10 months.
As we were just saying off camera, as it were, I have not moved from this couch in probably 9 months.
Yeah, I commented before we started that it's good to see your couch. And then I realized that I don't know if you're allowed to say that over Zoom.
Sure you are. Hey, do I understand correctly you recently lost your voice?
I lost my voice over the holidays. Yeah, which is when you talk for a living, not ideal. It's not ideal, but it's back. I lose it twice a year because I talk too much. You know that.
Okay. Is it okay if you talk some more today?
Oh, yeah. I'm here for you.
Thank you. So I want to talk about your column for IBJ this week. And you have this fascinating question from, I assume, a married couple, but a couple, about whether they should share their personal financial details with their three adult children. And I found this super interesting because I am an adult child. The question was, should these adult children be privy to information about how much their parents are worth, like where the money is, the estate plan, their plans for giving for charity, the whole ball of wax. And of course, it makes sense from kind of a practical standpoint, I guess, in that the children will eventually have to deal with all that. But the caveat, the writer says, is that the adult children have not seemed particularly interested in the past, specifically about participating in a donor-advised fund that the parents set up recently. And just real quick, what is a donor-advised fund?
Yeah, it's a charitable tool where the family can give away money in a strategic way. And so it's a advanced technique. Let's just put it that way.
Okay. So anyway, so they have a great question. We're going to tackle it in a second. But this question also recalled for me the tension in questions about inheritance between parents and their children. Tension that I'm sure we all have felt one way or the other. There's a really popular advice column on the website Money Watch called The Moneyist. It says its mission is to provide answers on the ethics and the etiquette of your financial affairs, but what it has evolved to become is basically Dear Abby for family money disputes. And a lot of the columns boil down to this basic question of whether you are entitled to someone else's money because you're related. And if you are entitled, how much are you entitled to? Does that ring a bell for you? Like in your practice over the years, have you seen people just assume that they are entitled to the family's money?
Absolutely. It's worth noting, I love very uncomfortable financial conversations. And the reason this topic is near and dear to me is because inherently, no pun intended, it is always, always uncomfortable because of this expectation. You know, my wife and I have some pretty interesting discussions, and we were talking about this idea that certain generations feel expectant of the previous generation to provide something. And they always get the rap that they're entitled. Oh, this generation's entitled. They have an entitlement. No. It's expectant. And I think this is the issue when it comes to inheritances and financial conversations amongst generations is it's not that a person feels entitled to that money. They simply expect it, right? And to me, that's the challenge. I don't believe, and this will make me wildly unpopular with those that pretend to love others. I don't believe you owe your family a thing financially. However, I do plan on leaving some things for my family. I do plan on paying for college for my kids, but I don't think that their opinion on that particularly impacts my willingness or ability to do it. And I think that's where it begins to get complicated.
Do you think it's fair to say that how money passes between family members, and especially parents and their kids, is one of the most problematic elements of personal finance?
Without a doubt. And you know, the question in the column was really fascinating because there was really two issues going on, right? There's this idea that this guy didn't know how much to share. And then he was upset that what he did share, the person didn't reflect his own excitement about the shared information. So let's tackle the first issue first. I don't think dollar signs really matter in this conversation. Tell them who your advisor is. Tell them who your estate planning attorney is. Tell them your charitable bequests, desires. But what does a dollar sign have to do with any of that? It's like reading the last page of a book and then having that information affect how you read the book. And for a lot of people, when you spill the beans too quickly and you get to the dollar sign too fast with young adult children or even middle-aged adult children, what you end up doing is creating moral hazard so that that person then in the moment makes decisions with other people's money and not the resources in front of them.
Wait, what do you mean by moral hazard?
Moral hazard is where risk is removed from a situation. So therefore the actor, the person making decisions, doesn't account for the fact that things could go wrong. And when you know an inheritance is coming, then in some respect, you remove the risk of running out of money, or you remove the risk of consequences, I should actually say. And to me, that is a moral failing that the older generation can prevent by simply refusing to talk dollar signs with the younger generation.
So when we say refusing to talk dollar signs, I mean, do we mean knowing your parents' total net worth or knowing how much they plan to give to you, or both?
Either and or both, as yeah, they would say. No one would say that, but I did. I don't think total net worth matters. I, in terms of sharing that information with anyone other than an advisor. And I also don't think what I'm giving you in terms of actual dollar signs particularly matters, because I think that affects a person's ability to create their own resourcefulness, which I view to be the ultimate financial skill, is resourcefulness. Now, here's the reason for this. I'm talking Mr. Tough Guy, despite the fact that I'm wearing a turtleneck today. I'm being a very tough guy, but there's a reason behind it. Mason, let's say that you've got tens of millions of dollars. Do you like this exercise?
I did not win the Powerball, apparently.
Oh, well. Anyway, let's say you have tens of millions of dollars. How you got the tens of millions of dollars, your failings, your successes, your struggles, your decisions, they're all internalized within you. You know the whole story. You know every element of that story. And theoretically, your significant other knows that whole story too. To then share the sexy part of the conversation, what the end result is to that with someone, takes away the true story of the struggle. And in this person's situation from the column this week, when this person began to try to share some of the information related to the success, the other person just simply didn't care. The adult child was like, eh, whatever, I'm disinterested. And they shouldn't be interested. You know, this person, as we talked about in the column, this person who emailed me was on a 10 out of 10 of being interested in their financial situation, as he should be. His son or daughter, whatever, was a five. And the guy was upset that his kid was at a five. Why should the kid be more than a five? It had nothing to do with the kid. And I think that's where, when a person is really proud of what they've done, as they should be, they expect their kids to reflect some degree of gratitude that frankly is unfair. I don't think you should look for validation in younger generations honoring your financial windfalls. I don't find that to be a fair ask.
Yeah, I thought it wasn't explicit in the question, but I thought that you could infer that really the person was kind of asking for permission to be insulted, that, you know, their kids were not interested.
And by the way, anytime anyone emails me, it always feels like I'm making these judgments as a columnist who answers questions. But honestly, I'm just making observations from what I've seen in 20 years. And as I pointed out in the column, one of the big struggles I've had in my career, now I'm laying on a couch and now you have the turtleneck on. One of the struggles I've had in my career is I've expected people close to me to reflect my own excitement back to me. That's a tough lesson I've learned that I've gotten much better at. And this person did the same thing. So I empathize with them. I don't point to them and laugh. I point to them and say, brother, I have been there, and expecting someone to reflect back the excitement of your situation, whether it's financial or otherwise, is a road you don't want to go down.
So let me go back to how this could backfire. Let me see if I'm getting you right. If I know that my parents are worth $2 million, and then I look at my own financial resources and go, well, you know, I got like 200,000 bucks saved and I'm already 53. I could be in trouble. But hey, you know, when my parents kick off, I'm going to be doing pretty well. That is not good financial planning.
Not only is it not good financial planning, but it's one of the more common techniques of financial planning that I regularly see. and here's the ugly truth to it that no one ever admits. And I know yours was a hypothetical, by the way, but this is something that no one ever.
Yeah, I've slightly more than 200,000.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So the issue is this: in order to have your day saved, in order for the rescue boat to pull up and pull you out of the water, someone's got to die, right? In order for your financial plan to come to completion, the people who raised you must be dead. And that's some Disney level stuff right there, my friend. You know, at the beginning of every Disney movie, someone's dead. Like, Disney is obsessed with death, and so are some people's financial plans. When I used to be a financial advisor, and I never would ask about inheritances because I don't care. But when people would bring it up, especially early in the conversation, I just knew we were in for some big behavioral issues because they were looking at that rescue boat. And the pragmatic part of it is this: A, there's no guarantee that that person will still have those level of assets when they do die. B, there's no guarantee that the relationship will still be as healthy as it is in the point in time. And by the way, when you see people dependent on someone to die to complete their financial strategy, Mason, you see relationships start to tatter because of that reality. Needless to say, things get real uncomfortable. I think I told the story before in my column about a fireman who loaned his son some money to get rid of credit card debt because he was so excited that his son was joining the company, which is a term apparently firefighters use. And so the firefighter, the son, showed up for work, you know, his first day as a recruit. I don't know any of these words. And he had a brand new truck. So this firefighter had made withdrawals from the dad from his own retirement to help his son get out of credit card debt. The kid got out of credit card debt and then bought like a $500 a month truck payment, and it just shattered. Mm. It burned down their relationship. And you see that sort of stuff all the time.
So if I feel like I'm getting, I mean, X amount of money coming to me, I mean, a nice chunk of change, $500,000, I am much less likely to be a responsible saver. Also, to be around your parents and constantly asking them, do you really think you need a new car? Or isn't that tenderloin a little expensive?
Yeah.
That's probably not good for the relationship.
Now, you know, one of the scarier things is when a loved one goes into an assisted living facility, and for lots of reasons. I mean, we're not even talking financial reasons here. It's a horrible time. Yeah. But you hear people say, oh my gosh, they're just blowing my inheritance in that place, right? Because those facilities are expensive and rightfully so, right? They provide a lot of services. But you see kids outside of the facility start making decisions to preserve the estate. And they'll say things like, oh, we got to make sure when dad gets out of there, he still has money. That's never what it's about, man. It's always about when dad dies in that place, we got to make sure we still have some of the estate left. And I know I'm being quite glib today. I know that this sounds like I'm very pessimistic about the human spirit here, but I've been doing this a long time. And that is a very common thing, spoken or unspoken.
What information about your finances and estate are you going to share with your adult children?
They will know the location of the PDB, which we've talked about on the show before, the Pete's Dead Binder, right? The PDB, the Pete's Dead Binder, where it's just it's a location. It is a binder. And it just says who to go to. Here are the professionals. Here's where to go to. Here are the account numbers. And then they'll just to get them organized. So then they can figure out what the will says, the directions there. And they're just along for the ride at that part. At that point, I'm not going to put them through anything, right? I'm not going to put them through the tragedy behind the tragedy of unweaving what has been woven financially. But at some point in time, money will flow. But until that time, they're not going to know anything. They're just going to know it's taken care of. And that's different between spouses, by the way. I think, Mason, where this gets tricky is if you have this tough guy attitude that I have, but you hold that same attitude with your significant other, then you are doing yourself and your significant other a great disservice. Couples should be on the exact same page here. It's where you get a step removed generation-wise is where there needs to be some distance and discretion.
So of the wealth transfers that you've seen over the years, when they go wrong, why do they go wrong?
Well, I think it goes wrong before the event. It goes wrong with the decisions a person makes prior to receiving the money, which puts themselves at a disadvantage. We like to say in our parts that money magnifies who you are, right? Money magnifies who you are. So if you are resourceful and you get more resources, then great. If you are not resourceful and you get more resources, that's problematic. And if I create a lack of resourcefulness because I let someone know that decades from now, I will bail them out with, you know, seven figures worth of money, I'm not helping their resourcefulness. I'm virtually guaranteeing that they will be unresourceful and those resources will be wasted. Please also allow me to say this is coming from a place of privilege and I need to acknowledge that, right? I mean, I'm being 100% transparent with you. This conversation is tough to stomach if you don't have financial stability and it seems very haughty and gross. But it is what it is, and I'm acknowledging that.
It sounded like when we're talking about Pete's Dead Binder.
Yeah, PDB.
I can't imagine that a lot of people have a I'm Dead Binder. That you would say that being very at least explicit about where everything is and making the process simple is very important.
I think we've all, up closer at a distance, experienced the disarray that can come with the passing of a loved one. And the reason I have a PDB, I'm turning it on right here, by the way. The reason I have a PDB is because I love my family and I want them to be able to grieve in whatever way they want for whatever they feel that they've lost. I don't want them to have to use their energy and their time to sort out their own stability at that time. And it's funny, this gets into the life insurance conversation, it gets into an estate planning conversation. We love to experience things with our family when we're here, right? We love to create memories, we love to go to Disney with masks on and all those sorts of things. But the harsh reality is your legacy, how your family remembers you when you're not there to create a new moment is just as powerful as your ability to create new moments while you're here. And I don't know, maybe it's guilt, but I cannot let my legacy be disarray when I'm dead. And maybe it's because I named myself Pete the Planner and I tell people what to do in a newspaper. But I don't know. I've seen so many estates look, this is the people that put their family in an organized position upon their passing have more of my respect than those that willingly look the other way. And boy, that's rough. I usually don't speak in those tough of terms, but it's noticeably different.
Here are a couple of scenarios. Is it wrong not to leave your kids an inheritance?
No.
Let's say we're talking to my parents. Why is it not wrong?
We connect it, right? We connect this idea of, well, we have the same last name. We've spent at least 18 years together. I provided for you. And now whatever is left is yours. Well, whether I do that or not, I don't think that's connected to some sort of obligation or expectation that it is done. I don't think that exists. And I don't want to raise my kids expecting that that will be there. I mean, if you ask my daughter to this day, and I think I've actually said this on your podcast before, if you ask her what she's going to do after college, you know, you're asking a career question of my 11-year-old, she will say, I don't know, but I know I can't live at home. You will hear her say that, right? And that's, again, I'm trying to set the expectation of problem solving to say, work backwards from that roadblock and the decisions you will make to avoid that roadblock, which is in the road, will be good for you. Now, look, if my daughter gets out of school, don't tell her this. She doesn't listen to your podcast, Mason. You don't have an 11-year-old subscriber. But if she gets out of school and times are tough, well, she's moving back in. I will make her scramby eggs every morning. But don't tell her that, right? Because I don't want to set that expectation.
One other scenario, and this is something that comes up in that advice column that I mentioned pretty frequently, is when kids get different sizes of inheritance.
Oh, yeah. No, that drives people crazy.
Yeah, that's nuts. In your experience, is it just maybe not a good idea, you know, for the parent to make some sort of value judgment about how much one person needs as opposed to somebody else? I mean, is it better just to split it as evenly as possible?
I said I loved uncomfortable conversations, and you're like, hey, let's go for the big daddy here. I'll just say this. It almost feels like when your kids are younger and you spend the same amount on them for Christmas or something, because out of this obligation of having things be equal. And I think it starts to blossom from there. Now, oftentimes what you'll see is one child ended up being the caregiver for a parent. Mm. So the parent's like, well, hey, you know, let's give them more money, or you get the house, you get the assets. And then the person's like, well, no, I wanted the assets. I don't want your creepy old house, because now I got to fix the house and sell the house. And so I think if you want to talk about conversations to have with generations, have that conversation. It has nothing to do with dollar signs. It has to do with percentage signs, right? It has to do with types of assets. I think that's a fair conversation to begin to flesh out as adults. Now, I'll also say this, and this is a big, bold, unfair statement. If you have this type of conversation with your family and it goes off the rails, it's fair to assume that you're the one to blame for that.
Why is that?
Because you're the one that raised these kids that can't handle that reality, right? I mean, you know, we rip on the trophy, the participation trophy generation. You know, oh, those kids, we're the one that gave them the trophies. Your kids ultimately, in these types of moments that have a lot to do with character, they are byproducts of you. And so if it becomes a difficult conversation that they can't handle, man, look in the mirror. And I say that knowing that that may happen to me. And my father-in-law and I had actually an interesting conversation about my column last week. I appreciate him both subscribing and reading. And we were talking about the dollar sign, right? Of, I said, you know, Jim, I don't ever care to know a single dollar sign of yours. I don't, none of my business, don't care. And he said, you know what? I said the same thing to my father-in-law and I meant it too. And he says, it just makes for a weird dynamic. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, I agree. I was like, hey, it's your life's work. We have nothing to do with it. Think about that. You have a 45-year career to put your family through school, to raise them, to help provide their health, and you got some left over. And with the disappearance of pensions, with only 10% of Americans have a pension, the fact that you might have money left over, what a highly personal thing to have happen. And for someone else to feel like they have ownership of that, alive or dead, is disheartening. And that's being generous.
I did want to bring up one thing that I'm glad you brought up. The child that does the majority of the caregiving. So often I hear stories of you know, discontented, you know, kids. Like, you know, I spend, you know, 40 hours a week taking care of mom, and, you know, and Bob, you know, lives in Oregon, hardly ever called mom for Christmas, and we got the same amount of money. And so that relationship is just poisoned.
Yeah, it poisons the memory of the person who has passed, and it obviously poisons the relationship for those that are still living, right? And this is one of those situations that where, Mason, if I give some witty piece of advice, like, you can't be upset by that. That's not helpful, right? Me telling you to not be upset is not helpful. Stop being sad. But you got to disconnect, both as the person leaving the money and receiving the money, caregiving, from some sort of financial cost that is associated with it. I mean, caring for your parents is an act of love. You're not repaid for your love with money. I mean, how ridiculous is that? You just sort of do what you do. And again, here's what I've learned in my career. I talk about these situations the way that my money mind works, and having not been in these situations, then I achieve these situations because I've lived longer. And my views shift, evolve. This is one I won't know until the horrible moment where I lose a loved one that is very close to me. And so I acknowledge that. But I'm also thinking about these things now and trying to prepare myself for the pain associated with their passing, not the pain associated with them not leaving me the amount of money I think I'm supposed to be left.
Yeah, the disconnecting is the hard part.
You know, I always struggle what to say to a friend of mine when I go to a funeral service for one of their loved ones. I'm sorry. Hey, this is terrible. I always end up going, seeing them. I walk up to the line or whatever, and I always stupidly say, how are you doing? Like, what do you mean, how am I doing? My father's laying dead behind me. I'm doing terrible. But and there's a beautiful saying in the Jewish faith, you know, may their memory be a blessing. Right. And I just think that is just the most I am not of the Jewish faith, but I find that to be the most beautiful thing. May their memory be a blessing. How can their memory be a blessing if you're concerned about how much they left you? And so to me, to honor someone's life and their existence is to take money out of it. Yeah, I know we're all adults and money is part of it, but the best way you can honor your family is to make sure money's not about it. I was telling some colleagues today at our State of the Union address of my organization. I said, everyone thinks our organization's about money. Our job is not about money. Our job is to make sure that everything else in a person's life matters other than money. We take money out of it, right? We make sure it's not an issue. From an estate planning standpoint and a bequests and inheritance standpoint, that's the same vibe. Make sure that you can worry about everything else and that money's not a part of it.
Well, thank you so much for helping spell out these issues. I mean, this actually kind of helps me figure out kind of where to figure these out in my own experience. So I really appreciate it.
No, it's my pleasure. These are my opinions, albeit informed opinions. And I just encourage, if you're listening to this right now, just think through it, talk through it, and do your best to leave dollar signs out of it, because they're not at all helpful, despite the fact that this feels like it's about money. It's not about money. It's about your relationship and the legacy of the people who may have left you.
With that said, I will look forward to talking to you next time. My thanks again to Pete Dunn. And remember, you can always catch his bi-weekly column on personal finance at ibj.com or in IBJ's print edition. And before you get on with the rest of your week, there are a few other items I want to draw your attention to in this week's issue. First up, the number of publicly announced philanthropic gifts of $1 million or more from individuals to Indiana organizations plummeted in 2020, along with the total value of the big donations. IBJ's Lindsay Erdody explores the potential reasons for the shortfall, some of which suggest that big donors are using other avenues to gift their riches. Also in this week's paper, John Russell pieces together the story of Osium Health, a secretive biotech startup that reportedly raised an eye-popping $60.9 million in funding last fall. And Greg Andrews explains how a non-traditional way of taking companies public is making buckets full of money for some Indianapolis business people engineering these deals. Again, you can find all these stories in the latest print edition of IBJ or online at ibj.com. I will say, here's the caveat, it's quite a bit easier to access all of the latest news and all of IBJ's data on Central Indiana's business community and economy if you're a subscriber. It works out to about $2 per week for actionable information you're not going to find anywhere else. Just go to ibj.com and click on the subscribe button. And thanks again for making time this week for the IBJ podcast, which is edited by Leslie Weidenbender. I'm Mason King. Hang in there, everybody. We'll be back again next week.